I'll call the Public Safety Finance Division to order. Members, today we're suspending the entire agenda on the Department of Public Safety. In your packet, you should have a memo from me that went out to explaining the memo that Ms. McMahon sent out to all the boards and agencies that were asking for additional information in addition to the governor's budget. We're asking agencies to provide us with proposals that would explain to us what actually would occur if they were asked to make 5 or 10% cuts in their budgets, ideas for further reforms and efficiencies, and as well as their strategic goals and how they're really measuring the success of what they're doing. So we should be getting that information. I'd also like to say, if I don't want to rush through today's session, this is the important part of our work, and if we do not complete the Department of Public Safety today, we will carve out another day next Thursday to finish that up. So with that, Commissioner, I'll turn it over to you and let you proceed. I'm also going to allow, if members have questions during the presentation, I'd rather get the questions out when they're timely, so feel free to interrupt. And then before you begin, Commissioner, I need someone to make a motion to approve the minutes of Thursday, February the 5th, 2009.
So moved.
Representative Ward moves the minutes. Are there any questions? All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Commissioner.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My members, Michael Campion. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety. We have Deputy Commissioner Mary Olson here at the table with me. We have spent some time, Mr. Chair, in preparation for this overview. We hope that it is concise and answers the questions that you and the rest of the members have. Our structure will go as follows. We have a 35 to 45 minute overview to include specific comments and a narrative from division directors. Secondly, we will attempt to answer the questions in the memo from Melanie McMahon, your clerk administrator. And thirdly, we'll certainly be willing during the testimony and at the end to answer any of the questions that the chairman or any other members have. Now, the Department of Public Safety's mission is simply to protect citizens and communities. We do this through a number of activities: prevention, preparedness, response, recovery, education, and enforcement. Our focus is on saving lives and providing efficient and effective services. Our mission also includes maintaining public trust and developing very strong partnerships. That is a very brief overview, and with that I would turn the next part of the presentation over to Deputy Commissioner Ellison.
Deputy Commissioner Ellison, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. What we're going to do is I'm going to give an overview of our entire budget that also includes divisions that are funded under the transportation section, just to give you an overview of the whole Department of Public Safety. And then today what we'll do is, as we discuss the various divisions that are within the purview of this committee, then we'll ask each division director to come up and say a few words and answer any questions that you might have at that time. So if we look at the 2010-2011 governor's budget recommendations, you'll see that our total budget is $615,244,000. The budget is broken up as follows. Highway user tax distribution is 3%. Trunk highway is 29%. State government special revenue is 20% of our budget. Miscellaneous special revenue is 19%. And the general fund is 29% of our overall budget within the Department of Public Safety. And if you look at expenses by category for our budget, 11% of the funds that we receive are transferred to other agencies. 1% are payments to individuals. Compensation costs equal 47% of our budget. Other operating costs, rent, and all the other things that we need to operate, 26%, and then assistance to local units of government assistance to local agencies that's not-for-profit, local units of government is 15%. In summary, the 2010-2011 governor's recommendations and direct appropriations is a 1% increase. That is represented by the forecast base and the budget change items that are in the budget materials. Within the Department of Public Safety division, the divisions that are included within the Department of Public Safety budget is Homeland Security and Emergency Management, Office of Justice Programs, Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Emergency Communication Networks, and the State Fire Marshal's Office. And within our Transportation division, we'll be giving them overviews as well in the coming couple of weeks, are the Minnesota State Patrol, the Office of Traffic Safety, Driver and Vehicle Services, Administration and Related Services in the Office of Pipeline Safety within the State Fire Marshal's Office. Just quickly, again, we're going to include all divisions, even though some of them are not included within this budget area, but just to give you an overview. The Minnesota State Patrol, their mission is to protect and serve all people in the state through assistance, education, and enforcement, provide support to allied agencies, and provide for the safe, efficient movement of traffic within Minnesota's roadways. The annual operating budget of the State Patrol is $82,406,000 for fiscal 9, and they have a staff of 954 full-time positions. For 10 and 11, their budget is $158 million from the Trunk Highway Fund, $184,000 from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, and $6,300,000 from the General Fund. The services within the Minnesota State Patrol are aviation, capital security, executive protection, the canine program, crash reconstruction, commercial vehicle enforcement, drug recognition experts, DWI enforcement, and they manage a large fleet, investigative services, public information, the training academy, radio communications, and the special response team. Driver and vehicle services. Their mission is to provide fair, accurate, secure, and timely service through effective service options, accurate collection of data, fraud prevention, efficient collection of state revenue, and quality information and technical support for staff and our business partners. DVS has an annual budget of $55.6 million with 534 employees. They collect a little over $1 billion a year in revenue for the state of Minnesota. The driver vehicle services is funded by a special revenue account that is in the ANDI Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. Within the driver vehicle services area, we have title and registration, auto dealer licensing and inspection, pro rate, driver exams, driver compliance, driver's license issuing, a public information center, operations support, and e-business. The Office of Traffic Safety, their goal is to move Minnesota towards zero deaths on our roadways through multidisciplinary application of education, enforcement, engineering, and emergency services. The Office of Traffic Safety receives an annual appropriation from the Trunk Highway Fund of $435,000 and a required match, which allows the Office of Traffic Safety to secure federal funds, grants, and one-time monies that annually amount to about $28 million coming to the state per year. Going on within the Office of Traffic Safety, they provide impaired driving prevention, occupant protection, child passenger safety, traffic records and data systems, Safe Community Coalition dollars that go to local units of government, motorcycle safety programs for teen drivers, underage alcohol prevention, traffic safety research and analysis, crash outcome and data evaluation, and fatal analysis record system that the state uses to analyze traffic crashes. Administration and support services within that area are our Office of Communications, the Commissioner's Office, Human Resources, Fiscal and Administrative Services, and the Office of Technology and Support Services. The State Fire Marshal, now we're moving into the areas that are within the jurisdiction. The mission of the State Fire Marshal Division is to protect lives and property by fostering a fire-safe environment. The funding for the State Fire Marshal's Office is a mix of fire safety account money and other special revenue funds. For 10 and 11, $15 million in special revenue will be provided to the office in direct appropriations. And I have with me with us, State Fire Marshal Jerry Rosendahl, who will say a few words.
Mr. Chairman,
please introduce yourself for the record.
Jerry Rosendahl, State Fire Marshal.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members, the Office of State Fire Marshal was created in 1905 in charge with the responsibility of investigating the origin, cause, and circumstances of fires and maintaining fire incident reports submitted by local fire departments. Funding, as Commissioner Ellison said, comes for the division, no longer comes from the general fund. Approximately 70% comes from special revenue direct appropriations via the relatively new fire safety account, and approximately 30% from fees and contracts for special revenue statutory appropriations. The fire safety account provides funding for the division as well as the Minnesota Board of Firefighter Training and Education for firefighter training, and also for grants for fire-related projects that have the potential for statewide impact. The estimated revenue for this biennium is $16 million. Once appropriated, the Fire Service Advisory Committee makes a recommendation to the Commissioner of Public Safety on how to spend the fire safety account. Quarterly collections from insurance companies were first due into this account in November of 2007, and $2.268 million is annually transferred to the general fund to replace the amount that was formerly collected as a fire insurance tax. Our investigation in terms of services assists local fire and law enforcement agencies with the origin and cause investigation of fatal fires, obvious arson fires, fires of suspicious nature, multiple injury, and large dollar loss fires and explosions. In 2008, 480 investigations were conducted by our staff. State Fire Marshal Division develops and enforces the state's fire code, conducting fire inspections in healthcare facilities, correctional facilities, public and charter schools, daycare facilities, and motels. Approximately 3,500 inspections and reinspections are conducted annually. We also conduct fire code training for local fire and building officials. We regulate those persons who manufacture, assemble, warehouse, or store explosives or blasting agents for purposes of wholesale or retail sale. We regulate the fire protection industry through licensing of contractors and certification of sprinkler fitters. We also certify the operators of public fireworks displays. We also certify all cigarette brand styles that are sold in Minnesota as being fire standard compliant. And I have a trivia question for you, Mr. Chairman. How many different brand style cigarettes are currently certified with us? And I'll let you think about that. I'll give you the answer in a minute. Over the governor's executive order for state agencies, the division responds to disasters or emergencies that require a coordination of fire services beyond daily operations. Our new online Minnesota Fire Incident Reporting System collects data from the state's 788 fire departments, typically over 200,000 incidents annually. This online version is provided free of charge to local fire departments, which can save each department hundreds of dollars per year because they don't have to purchase and upgrade commercial software. And finally, public education is the key to reducing fires and fire deaths. Our office acts as a resource for local fire officials who don't have the staffing to do this. Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if you have an answer for that question, but I'll let you know that there are currently 798 brand styles of cigarettes certified to be sold in Minnesota.
Very good. Mr. Rosenthal, if you're through with your presentation, I just a question. I'm just looking at the budget page page 59. I'm just wondering why we're seeing an increase in full-time equivalents in the governor's recommended budget.
Mr. Chairman, members, as you recall, the fire safety account funding went into effect and is now in place for our division funding as well as fire training on those special grants. And that money that is coming in has gone through that approval process, Fire Service Advisory Committee, the Commissioner's Office, and does allow us an increase in full-time staff. We are currently at 51. In 1996, we were at 63. So in terms of the staffing, we're considerably less than we were 12 years ago. But this allows us an additional four FTEs in the coming years.
And do you have excess amounts that in the fire safety account, or are you where you think we should be?
Mr. Chair and members, the fire safety account, as the collections come in, and we're still in the what I would call the first couple years of trying to figure out where that will stabilize at. The Fire Service Advisory Committee gets updates on the amount of that and then makes the determinations, recommendations to the commissioner on how to divide that up among the three areas that are allowed funding. In terms of excess, all of the money that has come in is directed at one of those three sources by that committee.
The reason I asked is because there was excess money in the fund last year. Obviously, we took it for other purposes, but there was extra money in the fund.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm sure we could debate the term excess. Last year or this current fiscal year, $2 million in addition to the $2.268 million was taken and transferred to the general fund.
Are there questions, Mr. Rosenthal?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to that point, so the revenues, when we made that change in the, I think it was the insurance premium that was increased to allow for that training, it's purely self-sustaining. There are no, I just want to get it clear, there are no funds coming from the general fund revenue. These are all fees that are collected through the insurance process.
Mr. Rosenthal.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, the fire insurance surcharge is 0.65% of the cost or the insurance premiums. That goes directly to that fire safety account and then out from there. No general fund money towards any of those three services.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, thank you, Mr. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
One quick question. Now, all of that money can only come out of that fund by the recommendations that Advisory Council, is that correct?
Mr. Rosenthal.
Mr. Chair and members, the Advisory Committee makes recommendations to the Commissioner. The Commissioner must approve or disapprove only what they provide them. He can provide feedback to them to say, this piece I'm not sure about, I'd rather have you take a look at that. But the Commissioner can only approve what comes out of that Fire Service Advisory Committee, as I understand the law.
Okay. Thank you for your presentation.
Mr. Chair, while Fire Marshal Rosenthal is up here, we'll also talk a little bit about the Office of Pipeline Safety since he supervises that as well. Their mission is to protect lives, property, and the environment through the implementation of a program of gas and hazardous liquid pipeline inspections, enforcement, accident and incident investigations, and education. And I would also throw out a trivia question that I hope Mr. Rosenthal can answer if I cannot, and that is how many miles of pipeline do we have going underground here in the state of Minnesota? So I'll let you think about that for a while, and then Mr. Rosenthal can answer that.
Mr. Chair and members, although the budget of the Minnesota Office of Pipeline Safety is not specifically reviewed by your committee, it is co-located in the Fire Marshal Division, and I serve as the Director of Pipeline Safety. MNOPS, as it's called, was created in 1987 following a major pipeline release that ignited and caused a fatal fire in Moundsview. Our inspectors inspect natural gas and hazardous liquid pipelines that run throughout Minnesota, coming in from and going out to locations all over the country. In 2008, the office conducted nearly 300 inspections of pipeline companies dealing with integrity management, public awareness, damage prevention, and operator qualifications. In 2009, there are several major pipeline projects in the works, including nearly 900 miles of large diameter, high pressure, interstate hazardous liquid pipeline and nearly 80 miles of large diameter, high pressure, intrastate and interstate natural gas transmission lines. In 2008, the office investigated nearly 200 pipeline incidents. Most of these reported to the Minnesota State Duty Officer and were caused by a third party digging into a pipeline. Our office enforces the damage prevention law known as Gopher State One Call. And I just note that the combination of enforcement actions and prevention education has contributed to a reduction of damages to gas and electric facilities by nearly 70% since 1996. And like the Fire Marshal Division, there is no general fund money in the pipeline safety budget. I know former Chairman Smith over here knows the answer to the question. There are over 65,000 miles of pipeline in Minnesota. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for your presentation. Anything else? That's been closed.
Very quickly, Mr. Chair, in addition to that, there's over 9,000 miles of large diameter, high pressure interstate transmission pipelines in the state of Minnesota, so I've read my budget book. You mentioned over 300 inspections of pipeline enterprises operations. Were there deficiencies found in some, all, many? Can you talk to me about, clearly, the inspection piece is important, an important public safety function that that the office serves, but do we have good operators, or are we finding problems?
Mr. Rosenthal.
Mr. Chairman and members, we have good operators in the state. I think our record indicates that. The inspections certainly do identify deficiencies. Our first focus, of course, is education and looking for compliance, not to come in with the hard hand of enforcement and penalties, although we have that authority as we inspect based on both federal law and state law that regulates pipeline companies.
Thank you for your presentation. Allison?
The commissioner whispered in my ear that I should be using my own material for the trivia question, so now I'll just throw out a question that I was asked in my confirmation class, and I never figured out the answer to, so if anybody knows it, they can just tell me afterwards, but that is, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? So if anybody knows that answer, then please let me know. Moving on, alcohol and gambling enforcement. The mission of alcohol and gambling enforcement is to maintain the integrity of legalized gambling, detect and vigorously pursue illegal forms of gambling, enforce the state's liquor laws, and monitor the state tribal gaming compact. Alcohol enforcement includes alcohol beverage licensing and permits, brand label registration, investigate alcohol-related complaints and investigations of licensed premises, alcohol promotion and advertising, imposition of civil penalties, enforcement of underage drinking laws, a retail alcohol vendor enforcement program. Gambling enforcement includes licensing of manufacturers and distributors of gambling equipment, assure compliance with state and tribal compacts on gambling, criminal enforcement, and investigation. The 10 and 11 budget of $1.685 million a year in general fund and $903,000 a year comes from special revenue direct appropriations. And there is a budget change item form that we can talk about as well. The special revenue money is derived from the Indian Nation compact, and what the special revenue monies come from the Indian Nation compact criminal background fees that are charged in gambling forfeitures. The 2010-11 funding reflects forecast base and the budget change item. The change item that we're referring to is a governor's proposal to transfer funds from the alcohol enforcement special revenue account to the general fund. That is projected at $750,000 per year for fiscal years 10 and 11 and $500,000 per year thereafter.
And
that special revenue fund was created a few years ago to hold fees that were collected for bars that wanted to stay open until 2 a.m. And that money was originally collected and used for enforcement activities, and about $140,000 was given to alcohol and gambling for the process of collecting, you know, for the covering the expense of actually collecting the fees. The enforcement activities are now covered under the Trunk Highway Fund through the State Patrol, and we're requesting that this money be then redirected to the general fund, and I'll let Mr. Willems explain it further if there's more details to that.
Want to introduce yourself for the record, please?
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Willems. I am the director of the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. Generally, CAFTER, our division, does exercise regulatory and law enforcement authority over legal and illegal alcohol and gambling activities within Minnesota. We are the sole state agency with responsibility for the alcohol industry and the sole state agency with law enforcement authority over gambling. In the area of gambling, we do perform some regulatory functions, generally as they relate directly or indirectly to tribal gaming. As the Deputy Commissioner noted, we do have the one budget change item, and this item actually reflects what, at least in my mind, is a simple accounting change. I say this because it neither increases or decreases the budget recommendation for the agency. The division does issue what are called 2 a.m. permits, and of the fees collected, the division retains currently $153,000. The remaining amount, estimated to be in the upcoming biennium, $750,000, is being directed now to the state general fund. Continuing, I do think we have some positive things to report to you today, and in the essence of time, I will simply offer them out in summary format and then respond to any questions the members may have. Two years ago, and more formally launched this past November, the division's No More Minnesota Nights campaign and MinScams.org efforts were launched. The division developed a public-private partnership called the Minnesota Fraud Enforcement Partnership. This is comprised of some 22 public and private entities committed to reducing the impact of online lottery and sweepstakes fraud in Minnesota. We estimate that as much as $30 million is lost annually to this type of crime within Minnesota, and since the launch, we have received about 40,000 complaints. We work with law enforcement across the globe and in this effort, and have even been successful in some areas of recovering some funds. These crimes often target the most vulnerable in our society and our state, and that is our elderly. And to personalize this and to offer as an example, we just recently received a complaint of one elderly Minnesota couple. Their daughter has reported to us that they have lost $1.5 million to these types of fraudulent scams. To help us improve and enlarge the MinScams.org program, we've recently applied for grants through private foundations, and we have yet to determine whether we'll be successful in those endeavors. We've initiated a new law enforcement effort to deal with illegal online or internet gambling. This is a new effort for us. Besides being unlawful, we see this as a threat to our legitimate gambling activities, and has at least been partially blamed for declining gambling revenues. In September, we conducted a joint online gambling investigation with the state of Washington, and in those efforts resulted in the seizures of $4.8 million in illegal gambling proceeds. Now, how you might ask how that's connected to Minnesota? Well, the key to that was a small rural Minnesota bank that processed $35 million in illegal wagers in a single year. On the alcohol front, we have initiated this past fall a retail alcohol vendor enforcement program, which we call RAVE. That effort has our agents and liquor investigators working in support of various DWI saturation efforts across the state. Our division staff work inside of the establishments primarily to ensure that underage drinking laws are enforced, as well as those laws prohibiting the serving of alcohol to obviously intoxicated are being complied with. We also follow up on all DWI arrests where we know the place of last drink, and we provide immediate on-scene presence to any DWI arrest during those saturation efforts where there's a blood alcohol content of 0.16 or greater. And the place, again, the place of last drink is known. This program has been well received by the industry, the state patrol, and local law enforcement agencies. Along with that, our agency operates a training program funded by a grant from the Office of Juvenile Justice Programs, directed to the enforcement of underage drinking laws. Just a point about that program is it was one of two that received national recognition as this past summer by that entity, and was recognized as one of the law enforcement agencies of the year for the endeavors that it has undertaken in that regard. We just initiated the process with the liquor industry to develop a long-term and effective regulatory solution to online and or foreign sales of alcohol into Minnesota, and hopefully we will be able, what we will develop in that program will be able to be applied to other regulated industries inside of the state. To increase our presence in gambling and alcohol industries, we are working more closely than ever with those other state agencies that have regulatory roles in them. Through an effort we refer to as coordinated compliance sweeps, we work with the Department of Revenue, Gambling Control Division, and both aspects of the gambling and alcohol sides of our house to bring to point all regulatory authority during those times of inspection, and to deal with any compliance issues, and to better educate the public as well. To better equip the front line of alcohol regulation, we have started a new training initiative directed towards local licensing authorities. As you know, Minnesota has a dual licensing system on retail licensed establishments. Local governments issue licenses as well as state permits being issued. So we completed the first of these events last month, and the first two sessions provided comprehensive training to some nearly 100 government employees that deal with the issuance of these licenses. This was so well received that we're expanding this program with new sessions that will be offered in March and April of this year and be taken across the state. So while I could probably speak endlessly about the positive things I think the division is doing, I would just like to conclude my time this morning with you by saying that the division remains committed to ensuring that in matters related to alcohol and gambling, that the public interest in these regulated industries and that the public safety remain paramount in all the things that we undertake. Thank you for allowing me to speak about my division this morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that testimony in terms of gambling conformity, you know, about I just got in the legislature 6 years ago, and we had a group of citizens come through Minnesota for Fair Gambling, and they were talking about some of the compliance issues with tribal gambling and with slots in particular, and that these slots were not being properly investigated. In fact, when the compliance checks were going in, they were going in identifying machines that weren't in, let's say, calibration, and that they were required to pull them off the shelf, but then there was no follow-up to see whether or not they had been fixed so that they were coming into compliance or not. My question is twofold here. Number one, is that currently happening? Are we actually going through a systematic check on the tribal gambling slot machines? And number two, is there any revenue generated for enforcement purposes to subsidize the positions that would go in and do that enforcement?
Is it Wallens? Can you spell your name for it?
W-I-L-L-E-M-S.
Mr. Wallens, okay, very good. Mr. Chairman? Can I respond to the member?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stevenson, the aspect of the agency's role in relation to tribal gaming often, I think, lead to some confusion exactly what it is we do. We do perform periodic, random, unannounced inspections of machines within the resources that we have available. We are not able to inspect every machine in the state. There's some 20-some thousand of them now within the resources that the division has. So we do inspect those that we are able to do, and we do try to get to each property a number of times each year. Having said that, these reports that came out, I think, several years ago, the most common issue that was reported at that time was a failure of what are called mechanical meters. Mechanical meters are simply mechanical instruments that have a number of digits on them, much like a speedometer on your car, the old speedometers, and frankly, they wear out and break. And so at that time, we were recording those as a machine that failed the inspection. When in truth, the rest of the machine and all of the player function and all of the accounting was operating quite properly, because all of these machines are connected to slot management systems, via electronic systems that have all been tested and approved and various things. And so all the full accounting of that happened. Mechanical meters are a throwback to the early 80s technology, and they remain part of the definition of a slot machine, although increasingly they're becoming less and less common on them, and so the failures are less and less common. When we found those failures, often the mechanical meters were replaced in front of us at the time before we ever left the property, or we were noticed up and the slot techs, the tribe's document that the repair has been made. So when we did notice that there was a failure of those machines to meet those specifications, we did receive confirmation from the tribe that those, from their regulatory authority, that those repairs had been made and the machine was back in flight or not. So in one sense, they did fail. In another sense, it had no impact on the play, the legitimacy of the game, the counting, or any other functionality of the machine that was core to it. We changed the...
Ms. Davidson, anything else?
Just to the second part of the question, Mr. Chair, is there any revenue generated?
We receive $150,000 a year under the Blackjack Compact. We receive nothing under the Video Games of Chance Compact. We receive $150,000 a year total. That's about $13,636 per tribe per year for our services. In addition to that, we receive a $15 fee for each name check or record check that we run in response to the background investigation. Of that, $7 goes to the general fund and $8 is put into a special revenue account for the agency to use.
And Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. And so Mr. Williams, does that cover the FTE cost for the enforcement on the tribal gambling?
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, the truth is that, we have responded to a request from a legislator on this, and in looking at those numbers, we really tried to manage that well, but we still have a shortfall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You spoke about the program about minors, that you're working very hard to keep minors from drinking alcohol and this great program. But with the budget cuts that are coming, for example, proposed by the governor to the court, there's discussion about what they might not do in the court. Should the court decide that they can't afford to do minor consumption processes, what impact would that have on your program?
Mr. Williams.
Most of our, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilster, members of the committee, the most of our activity is directed towards the retail alcohol vendor, the licensees that we have control over. So that is really where we direct our enforcement efforts, and I really probably can't speak clearly to the impact that the courts, a reduction in the courts would have on this particular issue. We do manage to pursue most of these things administratively outside of the court system because of the issues that you're speaking about already, and just the backlog on prosecutors and various things. So we do use our administrative remedies as much as possible, and are increasingly doing that across the board. So in the cases of having a retailer sell to a minor, those remedies will always be available to us, regardless of what happens with the courts.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me what is that process that you have and what tends to be your remedy that you seek?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Hilstrom, the process is simply the administrative process in which we issue a notice of proposed hearing or violation or penalty and agency action. That's issued under the authority, and this follows in line with the Minnesota Administrative Procedures Act. We generally, first offense for civil penalties is about $200 that we impose a civil penalty, and then there is a record created on the license for future events that escalates. We are limited by statute to $2,000 a civil penalty. That's an incremental increase typically, but egregious offenses can certainly be accumulated. The person who receives that notice has the ability to contest the matter and receive due process through the administrative law process and going before a hearings officer through an administrative law judge for review and decision making.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Williams, you in your comments, you mentioned something about men scams, and I was looking in the budget book here. And I think you mentioned that you'd recovered some funds actually through that program. But in the key measures of the budget book here, it says the number of complaints taken regarding lottery sweepstakes funds has gone up, and you're getting like 25,000 complaints now or something on your complaint line. What do you do with those? Are they connected? Am I connecting the right things here? I mean. So it's just we're getting more complaints, and you have an objective to try to deal with that. I think you mentioned you recovered some funds, but what do you do with these complaints, and how do you actually use that?
Mr. Willem.
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, the response to that is this is a new program that we've been undertaking. It was something that was not being dealt with in the state. We receive those complaints, and through the Men's Scams effort and through the partnership, we deal with this in a number of different ways. But as of right now, those complaints, either through the phones, the web-based reporting, or through the email reporting, are totaling about 40,000. Of those, we analyze those complaints for those where there has been a victim loss, and if there's been a victim loss and there's some immediacy, we have our law enforcement staff try to follow up on those as quickly as we can. In some cases, we're able to respond very quickly. We're able to get the necessary information from a victim. We're able to track that money, and working with authorities, oftentimes outside of the United States, in Canada and elsewhere, stop the flow of those assets to the people who are trying to get them. We intercept them in the banking system, freeze those accounts, and then go through a process in that country to recover that fund. And so we are able to do that. In some cases, we're able to increasingly, one of the members of the partnership is the County Attorney's Association. So they're taking an active interest in this, and we are referring some cases for criminal prosecution to them as well. These are tough cases in the sense that the victims are elderly, these are tough cases because the victims, and I'm not trying to diminish anything from a crime of violence, but they often have what I guess I refer to kind of a rape victim mentality. They're embarrassed, and they feel like they've deserved this and earned this, and they don't want to talk about it, and they don't want to talk to their family, and they're just awkward about this whole thing, and oftentimes they just want it to disappear, and so we have to build a level of trust with them and to work the cases as well. We refer cases out to other jurisdictions. To work. We worked a lot with the Canadian authorities, quite active with the Canadian authorities, but we also are working in the UK and Spain actively. We have, we disable phone numbers where we get these phone numbers. We disable email addresses so people cannot respond. We work with the internet provider services. Microsoft has been a huge support to us. Google has been a huge support to us. Others, Yahoo and others, a little less so, but frankly they're participating in the program, and so we're able to disconnect these people from being able to communicate. We do a bunch of education efforts, we do a lot of training along those lines, and then when we are able to recover some funds, we are able to restore those to the victims. Unfortunately, they've often lost more than we're able to recover. And it's too bad because these are elderly people that will never recover this money. They can't get a job and go out and make it back.
I think you alluded to what I was curious about, because I mean it's such a huge problem that involves the internet, involves the technology that's out there today. So we do work. There is kind of a coalition of states and organizations around the country and a network that we're connected with actually internationally is what you're saying, that actually helps us to respond to this stuff and have a and we're developing a faster and a better and a more effective way to actually address it. Is this scam industry growing faster than we are slowing it down?
Mr. Whelan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, representative. Issue is they really were given a free rein by many people for a vast number of years, and so they're really ahead of us, and their organizations are well established and well run, and they're very much professional con artists. There's some violence that goes along with these victim lists and other places. There's increasingly the Caribbean and places like Jamaica are becoming hotbeds of this activity. These lists of victims have value and they sell them. But we are really trying to develop. This is really the first place in the United States the program of this nature has been developed. So we continue to make new ground, and we learn as we go, and we try to teach it to other people. There's interest in the program. We're trying to regionalize it as one of the efforts under the governor's auspices with the Wisconsin-Minnesota initiatives. But we also, not all of these complaints that we get are for us. We try to refer them to the proper law enforcement agencies, but we also are becoming a recipient from other law enforcement agencies of these complaints.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Of the witness, Mr. Williams, when you were discussing the budget change item, the transferring of funds from the Alcohol Enforcement Special Revenue Account to the General Fund, you're proposing a transfer of $750,000 a year for 10 and 11.
Did I hear you testify that would leave you with $153,000 in that account?
Mr. Willems.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, members of the committee, the answer to that is I believe that is a budget projection for the revenues. It varies from year to year. It depends upon how many people renew their 2AM licenses or apply for new ones. There is a scale of fees on that based on their gross sales reported to the Department of Revenue, and declining sales obviously would impact that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith.
If you're transferring $750,000 and you're retaining $153,000, what do you propose to buy or do with that
$153,000? Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, the $153,000 goes to the issuance of the permits, the staff that does that, the maintenance of the equipment, and the enforcement of those 2AM permits. So it touches the liquor investigator staff, it touches the licensing authority staff, and it touches the administration of that program. So the way it has worked to this point is we keep the first 153, the balance goes to the enforcement account, and from that would be transferred to the general fund.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Williams, retaining $153,000 and transferring $750,000, will that diminish the activity you described that you would be doing with the $153,000?
Mr. Willem.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, no, it would not. It would leave us the same as we are.
Mr. Chairman, final question. Mr. Willems, will that loss of transfer of $750,000 a year be made up in any way by transfers from the general fund to your operation?
Mr. Willem.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, no, it will not. We are still, it either increases or decreases our budget from what it has been.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hausman, I think we probably should move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Williams, I would like to do a follow-up question from the question asked by Representative Severson. If there's a shortfall, what amount of dollars is in the shortfall for the inspection versus the collection of fees?
Mr. Willem.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the upshot of this is that there's money that's collected and put in a special revenue account that we don't have access to, is really the answer. So it's projected that there would be $750,000 per year collected in fiscal year 10 and 11 in a special revenue account. However, the Alcohol and Gambling Division can only spend $143,000 or $150,000 for the activities that Mr. Willems mentioned. So it's collected in a special revenue account, and it's sitting in the account, and it's not being used for any purpose that we are aware of at the time. I hope that's clear.
That's good.
Sure, I think it is quite clear. But let me see if it comes out clear when I say this. There's a shortfall not in the money collected, but in the money that you can spend from the money that was collected. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, you could call it a shortfall. I mean,
I wouldn't. I probably would not call it a shortfall. I would call it money collected that I can't get over to that account, which is, to me, Mr. Chair and testifier, is different than a shortfall. A shortfall, to me, would indicate that not enough money is being collected. Thank you.
Deputy Commissioner Ellison, do you want to take another crack at it, or are you...
Mr. Chair, are you talking about the special revenue accounts that we collect from the tribes?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was talking about the other special revenue account.
Let's start over then.
Mr. Williams to describe more clearly. I apologize.
No problem. Same question.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Haas, we had received a request from House Research earlier this month or in January concerning the matter of the cost of tribal gaming regulation. We just looked at 2008 as the best indicator, so I'll speak to it from that perspective. In that, we tried to estimate the best cost we could is what it cost the agency to perform its inspection work and other activities related to tribal gaming, and we estimated that Again, our best estimate was roughly $323,000. We looked at the reimbursements that we received from Tribal Gaming, and that looked to be about our best number for that was $291,000, and I'm just rounding these estimates. And that left us roughly about $32,000. Our cost, unfunded costs for that effort were about $32,000. And that's for 2008 and reflects our best efforts to try to manage those costs and stay within what we receive.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up.
Mr. Chair,
thank you to the testifiers. Then the deficit or the lack of dollars collected is $32,000. That's the amount of dollars we're talking about.
Mr. Williams.
Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Haught, if we look at what it costs us versus that, the answer is yes. Cost versus the income, $32,000 difference.
I need one more question so I try to understand this. Is the $291,000 collected, is that the total collected, or is that half of what, and the other half going into the general fund? How much of the collected, half of it goes into the general fund. Does half of your $291,000 go into the general fund?
Mr. Willem.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Todd, this is reflects the amount that is put into our special revenue account for our work. It does not include the general fund. The $7 that goes to the general fund.
Representative Haar,
can I do one more?
Please, go ahead.
Thank you. So then, are you collecting from the tribe? Are you collecting twice the $291,000, or are you collecting $291,000?
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Pott, no, it is not twice, because that $291,000 also includes the $150,000 annual contact payment. What we're talking about are the numbers related to the background checks and the fingerprint fees that they submit. We do not collect any money or make any benefit off of the revenue benefit off of the fingerprint fees. There is a $15 fee that was raised several years ago, and another legislature to help us with some costs, and the legislature directed $7 of that to go to the general fund at that time.
Mr. Hasey, more satisfied?
Yeah, I just know. I just want to find out if there's an actual deficit, I mean, or an actual not enough money collected from the tribe, and that's what I'm trying to figure out is, we're not, are we or are we not collecting enough money from the tribe in order to pay for the fees that you're doing, including money that maybe is transferred to the general fund or whatever by us?
Mr. Williams, I would suggest, Mr. Williams.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, let me try to make this. In 1989, the compacts were developed, and the amount of $150,000 was established at that time. It's 2009, we collect the same amount of money. That may put it in perspective. Maybe an attempt to answer the question.
Maybe you could put all this in a memo and explain this a little bit more, since there obviously seems to be a little confusion in the end for the, just because we're running out of time.
Thank you.
Sir, if I may, just a final comment on this question, and then I'd be happy to throw this up. Members of the committee, Representative Pott, of the money that is apportioned to the division for its regulatory enforcement work related to tribal gaming, it's $32,000 in 2008, over less was collected than the cost incurred. That does not include the amount for the general fund, which would be less than the difference between 150, would be somewhere probably about $130,000 that went to the general fund.
So you'll put something in writing. I still think we're in some confusion. Thank you for your testimony. Deputy Commissioner, you want to proceed?
Mr. Chair, moving on to the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, their mission is to help Minnesota prevent, prepare for, respond to, and recover from natural and human-caused disasters. The funding for, in addition to extensive program activity, HSEM is a pass-through for sizable federal grant amounts. We pass through a lot of money to local units of government. The general fund budget for the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division includes $2.514 million per year. All the other funding sources are through federal grants, mostly from Homeland Security and FEMA. In fiscal year 09, HSEM will expend approximately $81 million in local assistance to over 300 government and other entities. I will let Ms. Ivy take it from here. She's the Director of the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division.
Ivy, you want to introduce yourself for the record, please?
For the record, my name is Chris Ivy. I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. We have four branches and the School Safety Center within the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. In the Field Services branch, we manage the Emergency Planning and Community Rights to Know Act, which deals with about 6,000 facilities that use, manufacture, or store hazardous materials. We also have regional operations. We have six regions within the state of Minnesota, each with a regional coordinator. We have a training and exercise program. We have staff that provide state-developed training and federal training to emergency managers and partners. We also have volunteer resource coordination. We work with the private nonprofit organizations that are active in disaster, and we coordinate those efforts. We also have the Homeland Security Branch, which has several programs within it. The Critical Infrastructure Protection Program, which deals with the private sector that own the critical infrastructure within the state of Minnesota, which if an incident happened at one of those critical infrastructures, it would affect the United States and the United States economy. We also have a partnership with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and the Minnesota Joint Analysis Center. This year we are adding a fire staff into that so that we can work with the fire community also in the Minnesota Joint Analysis Center. We have the Senior Advisory Council, which is a 27-member committee chaired by Commissioner Campion and the Commissioner of Health, Commissioner Mangan, and it includes the sectors of the Homeland Security partners, which then make the policy decisions for Homeland Security funding in the state of Minnesota. We have a Homeland Security Grant Program, and this past year we received about $12.6 million for one program and $8.5 million for the Urban Area Security Initiative. In addition, we also do the grants for the critical infrastructure, and in the Homeland Security Grant Program, there's also some Fire Act grants and some Emergency Communication Network grants, which we partner with the other divisions in public safety. State Emergency Response Commissions. We have 10 chemical assessment teams. We have one emergency response team and four bomb squads within the state of Minnesota that we coordinate. The Preparedness Branch is where we have our emergency planning. We're required to coordinate planning across the state of Minnesota, and we coordinate the Minnesota Emergency Operations Plan. It is managed by the Minnesota Emergency Preparedness and Response Committee, which is also a committee of all the 23 members, or the 22 state agencies that have emergency responsibility as in the executive order. The Radiological Emergency Preparedness Program is also in the Preparedness Branch, and that works with the two nuclear power plants within the state of Minnesota, one at Monticello and one at Prairie Island. We have four risk communities. We have 32 ingestion pathway communities, and this group of folks work with Northern States Power Minnesota and those communities for preparing and to allow Xcel Energy to keep its license for those plants. The Response Recovery and Mitigation Branch is the branch that has the staff responsible for emergency operations. Those are the folks that activate the State Emergency Operations Center and coordinate the activities there among the local units of government and other state agencies. The post-disaster recovery programs are individual assistance programs and the public assistance programs, and work with other state agencies and communities on recovering following a disaster. They manage the public assistance grants, the individual grants, and then long-term recovery with FEMA and with state and local government. Pre-disaster mitigation and hazard mitigation grant programs also is in this branch. Mitigation is the prevention or the lessening of the impact of a future disaster. So what we do is we work with communities on analyzing their hazards, developing local policies for lessening the impact of disaster, and then providing grant funds as they are given to us by the federal government. Also, our public education campaigns are in this branch, which is the Severe Weather Awareness Week, Winter Hazard Awareness Week, State Preparedness Month, and the Code Ready Public Education Campaign. The School Safety Center was new in August of 2007. It's a cooperative venture with the Department of Education and provides technical assistance to school districts in school safety and emergency planning issues. They have developed and they maintain the school safety planning guide. They provide technical classes, and they provide also a connection to do assessments for school districts and are working with the superintendent's association very, very closely on these initiatives.
Ms. Reddy, was there any public safety money involved in the school safety program?
Those are two federal grants in the school safety program.
Thank you.
Is that my last one?
Yeah.
Okay, and in addition, I just wanted to share some of our accomplishments over the last few years. On page 27 of your budget book is the budget activity for emergency management performance grants. For our disaster recovery programs, we have we had three disasters in 2008. We had the I-35W bridge collapse in August of 2007, the Southeast Minnesota floods in August of 2007, and then in June of 2008, we again had the Southeast Minnesota floods. We have had 20 presidential declarations in the past 12 years. 9 of those declarations are still considered open. When you have damage to infrastructure and you continue to have damage to the public infrastructure, it takes a very long time for some of those projects to be completed. So we still have 9 open disasters that our staff is managing. And we've distributed $34 million in federal and state disaster monies within those last 12 years. We had 83 emergency management classes and 17 school safety center classes, resulting in over 29,000 student contact hours. For our nuclear plant preparedness budget activity, which is on page 30 of your budget book, we have hosted 2 full-scale drills and exercises, which involve 431 state and local personnel. These are drills and exercises which are actually full-scale drills. The state EOC, the local emergency operations center, our field teams are out in the field simulating releases from the monitoring the releases from the nuclear power plants. 3,000 people were trained in the last 2 years on their procedures for response to a nuclear power plant emergencies.
Ms. Reddy, can I ask you, so the nuclear power plants assessed for, what are their assessments for?
Mr. Chair, their assessment is about $2.7 million every fiscal year. Mm-hmm. I believe if you were to look at page 26 of your budget book, to be more precise, it was $2.639 in fiscal year 2009. Then in 2010 and 11, we have a new requirement, which is called a hospital-based action drill, which will require a lot more drills, exercises, training, and another staff person. And so we have worked with Northern States Power Minnesota for increasing that assessment to $3,113,000.
And does that cover the necessary costs for training and inspection?
Mr. Chair, it does.
And has that stayed at 2.7 over the years, or is it increasing?
Mr. Chair, that has increased exponentially over the last 15 years because of the increased federal requirements for the nuclear power industry.
And do we get, Ms. Eddy, do we get any federal assistance given post 9/11 for this kind of assessment and training?
Mr. Chair, no, we do not get federal assistance for nuclear power because it is in the it is to be assessed to the nuclear power producer.
Okay, that's cool.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman Zaidi. I noticed a significant, and clearly a little more interested in the general fund appropriations, but a significant decrease in the federal appropriations for 10 and 11. Is the money that's there, the $38 million in 10 and the $31 million in 11, is that projected, or is that money we know we're going to get? And does that all come with strings attached? In other words, do we have to spend it as the feds tell us how we're spending it?
Ms. Ivey.
Mr. Chairman, of course, that is an estimated amount based on the length of our grants and knowing what kind of disaster grants we also have out there, and they all come with strings. A Homeland Security grant program is very strict in how we intend to spend it, and then it's monitored as to how we do spend it. Also, we have a match program, which is the Emergency Management Performance Grant, is a 50-50 match. So we get 2.514 general fund for that program, and that's to match the federal grant that we get for that, and that's part of the $38,732 for 2010.
Representative Peterson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, I guess I'm wondering if the FD positions that are funded under this, I would assume that they're all state positions, but has there been any consideration given to tying the positions to the federal dollars that are go out there, so when the federal dollars are reduced, those positions are identified as FD and they drop off the chart? Ms. Ivey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Severson, we have a 50-50 match on many of our positions. We have other positions that are 100% federal funding. So when federal funding programs would go away, that staffing would have to decrease.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Please go ahead.
The Community Right to Know Act, which is on page 33 of your budget book. As I mentioned earlier, we have over 6,000 facilities which are subject to the reporting requirements of that program. And we collect approximately $1.3 million over the last two-year period, which goes into the general fund.
Ms. Andy, where are those fees collected from?
Mr. Chair, those fees are collected from those 6,000 facilities, dependent on what kind and how many hazardous materials they store, manufacture, or use.
Okay.
In our key measures section, we have met our goal of applying for declarations within 30 days. We have 13 grant programs, and we have administered 901 grants. 375 of those are disaster-related grants. Those grant contracts, we had a goal of developing those grant contracts within 30 days of receiving all the necessary information, and we met 100% of our goals. For our radiological emergency preparedness program, with the assessment, we have conducted all of our exercises and not received a deficiency. In this past Perry Island exercise, which we performed in partnership with the state of Wisconsin, we did receive four areas that needed to be redemonstrated. However, we redemonstrated three out of those four at that same exercise, and we will redemonstrate that one area in August of this year at the Monticello exercise. For our emergency preparedness and right to know, we have 95% of our facilities that are now reporting online, which has been a long process of getting that online reporting, because many of our facilities are very small, privately owned facilities, and we are now at 95% capacity of that. This is a few other notes. Last year's legislature gave us $5 million in bonded money for the construction of Emergency Management Training Center. We are now through the pre-design of that and into the design phase of selecting an architecture firm to design and build that phase one of the training center up at Camp Ripley. So we're very, very pleased with the progress. Also, in last year's legislature, it was required that the 22 agencies that are listed in the executive order for having responsibilities in emergencies have a minimum of one person trained as a certified emergency management director, and that we report to the legislature each January on the process of that. All 22 state agencies have complied with that reporting, and we are well on our way of having certified emergency managers within those state agencies.
Excuse me, Ms. Idy, what's going to call?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Ms. Idy, I'm looking at the community right to know portion, and can you help me understand why what public safety is doing isn't overlapping with what the pollution control agency does? I mean, specifically with regard to this program that PCA apparently now has all this information online, why do we need to continue to do the community right to know stuff? Why isn't there an overlap there, and why couldn't PCA do it?
Ms. Idy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cole, there is a partnership there with the PCA. We provide them with our data so that they can also collect the data that they need. This is also a partnership with MnDOT on those agencies that also transport, those companies that transport hazardous materials. So we collect the data, and then we provide the data to the PCA and to MnDOT as requested and required.
Ms. Idy, maybe you don't know the answer to this question, but is PCA or MnDOT collecting that information as well?
Ms. Idy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, I would have to get the details of that from our staff person to get that information to you, which what's duplicate and what we collect and then we provide.
Ms. Idy, I would appreciate that. Anything we can do to eliminate duplication of services, not only at the state level, but for our private employers as well, would be a good idea.
If you can make that document to the whole committee, please.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. Please continue.
This last biennium, our hazardous materials teams have responded to 25 incidents. Our bomb squads responded to 180 calls outside of their jurisdiction. And over this last biennium, we have also, or over this last two disasters, we are also now eligible for $11 million in those hazard mitigation grants that I mentioned that are to lessen the impact of disaster. We are currently preparing for the floods of 2009 up in the Red River Valley. There is a 90% chance of major flooding in the Red River Valley, according to the National Forecast Office. And if you recall the damages in 1997 and again the near record floods in 2006, the mitigation projects that we put into place after the floods of 1997 saved about $100 million worth of damage in the Red River Valley. We're anticipating that also because of the additional mitigation that has been done and completed in the Red River Valley will continue to save lives, save property, and save taxpayers' money.
Thank you, Ms. Friday, for your presentation. Any questions? Thank you. I think we're going to try, Commissioner, maybe get one more division in. I'm going to try to get OJP in here, and we'll see how far we go.
We'll get the Office of Justice Program in here, and we'll take your direction from there. The mission of the Office of Justice Program is to provide leadership and resources to reduce crime in Minnesota, improve the functioning of the criminal justice system, and assist victims of crime. Their general fund appropriation is $37.2 million per year. In addition to programming, OJP administers grants to nonprofits and local units of government totaling $47 million per year. I'm going to let Ms. Bovaire describe the services that are offered within the Office of Justice Program.
Ms. Bovaire, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jerry Bovaire, for the record, and I'm the Director of the Office of Justice Programs. I appreciate this opportunity to highlight some areas of the budget and mention some of our accomplishments over the last year. The first budget activity I'd like to talk about is reparations on page 104. There are three programs that are reflected under this activity: the reparations program, the crime victim justice unit, and the training and communications team. The reparation program, which provides compensation for losses as a result of a crime, has had a steady increase of claims over the last 4 years, and in fiscal year 08 they had over 1,800 claims. They provide over $3 million in compensation. And despite the increase in claims, The staff were able to reduce the case processing time, and 93% of those served rated their services as very good, good, or fair. The Crime Victim Justice Unit, which provides assistance in navigating the criminal justice system and investigates victim mistreatment and violations of crime victim rights, had over 3,000 contacts in fiscal year 7 and 8 from victims, advocates, and the public. They opened 97 crime victim rights violation cases. Our training communications team, which provides state crime victim training, the annual conference on crime victims, and the Victim Assistance Academy, also manages the VINE system, which is our victim information notification everyday system, the automated system that provides real-time change of custody information on all offenders. VINE is active in 70 of the 79 counties with jails, and we are working on adding the remaining 9 by the end of the year. In the last year, over 29,000 notification calls or emails were delivered. We also support a crime victim liaison position in the Department of Corrections, and last year, the staff person provided victim input on over 800 end-of confinement review hearings. The next area is our primary grant activities. Over the biennium, the OJP grants teams administered over 600 grants and 300 amendments to nonprofits, state and local units of government to prevent and reduce crime and violence, improve the criminal justice system, and serve crime victims. They use our web-based grants management system, which manages all grant activities online from application to closeout. I provide a list of our grantees along with our monitoring protocol. Page 106 and 108 are the Crime Victim Assistance and the Battered Women Grant Program budgets. The CD Grants team administered grants to over 150 agencies who provide direct service to victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, and general crime. They conducted over 100 program and technical assistance site visits and nearly 50 desk audits in fiscal year 08. The reductions in general funding in these key crime victim service budget activities that I just discussed are the result of one-time grant appropriations, specifically a one-time increase in the emergency fund, the out-of-debt impound reimbursement fund, and only 737 of the $1.7 million increase for crime victim services that was appropriated each year in 08 and 09 is in the base for 2010 and 11. Page 110 is the Law Enforcement and Community Grants Division budget. Again, you'll note that there's a decrease in general funds. This is also a one-time grant program appropriation. This team administered a wide variety of state and federal grant programs over the last year, including community crime prevention, youth intervention and prevention, juvenile delinquency, gang intervention, homeless outreach, school safety center, squad car cameras, defibrillators, offender reentry, family dependency courts, gang and drug task forces. This team conducted over 120 program and technical assistance site visits and completed over 50 financial desk audits. Our law enforcement team conducted extensive assessments of the 24 gang and drug task forces to ensure fiscal and administrative compliance and best practices operations. They have developed corrective action plans for task forces in need of improvement. They also facilitated training to over 700 officers. We're extremely proud of our relationship with our grantee partners and of the great work that they're doing in our communities to improve public safety and serve crime victims. Thank you again for this opportunity, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
I have a question. I have a question for one question, Ms. Mulvare. So the governor is not recommending basically the base appropriation, similar base appropriation from 08-09 for crime victim programs. And are we anticipating any federal money for crime victim programs in either the House or the Senate stimulus package, assuming that there's agreement sometime this week?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, in the compromise bill, at least the potential still exists for both increased JAG funding and crime victims funding.
And would that money then go to supplant any general fund money, or would that money be, what would happen in that case?
We have not received, Mr. Chair, we have not received clear definitions on how the funds can be used, and supplant is generally not allowed with federal funding. But everyone is awaiting clarification on how the funds can be used.
So, Ms. Bovera, is potentially then the state could use those funds for other crime victim services?
Mr. Chair, the potential exists.
Okay. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the witness, can you help me understand on page 108 of my budget book here, we've got, according to the budget book, unless it's a mistake, there are zero FTEs administering almost $20 million of grants to battered women's shelters. Is that a mistake, or can you help me understand that?
It's not a mistake.
Mr.
Chair, Representative, that's, the FTEs that cover those are reflected in the Crime Victim Assistance budget on page 106.
Representative Poole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just the FTEs on page 106 are taking care of both the Crime Victim Assistance Grants and the Battered Women's Shelters Grants. Is that correct?
Ms. Bovea.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
And Ms. Bovea, you... thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Bovea, you... Is this chart here the document that you were referring to that outlines the monitoring program?
Which chart is that, Representative
Poole? I think in members' packets there was a handout of grants, and it stapled its last page, I believe.
Yeah, okay. Okay, go ahead. What was the question?
Is this OJP's grant monitoring protocol?
Ms. Bovea.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Bovea, I don't have any further questions at this time because I haven't had a chance to review this, but we've got an entity that is overseeing $47 million worth of grants. Just raises some red flags. Not that the grants aren't being appropriately managed, but I have some questions, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time now, but I do have some questions about sort of the process that's being used and how we make sure that there's not duplication of services by the grant recipients, and whether there might be, even on the margins, an opportunity for some savings here with some of these grant programs. $47 million is a not an insignificant amount of money, as you know, Mr. Chair, and we're going to be looking for nickels and dimes by the end of the day. So I'm not sure if there's a question there, but I may want to follow up with Ms. Colbert and get some more information about that after the hearing.
Do you want to respond to that? Do you feel like you have sufficient oversight over the sexual assault and domestic and battered women's programs?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do feel we have really solid protocols and adequate staffing for the jobs at this point, and I'd be happy to follow up with you.
Okay. Any other questions of OJP services? Do you want to answer the final question?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, and to the testifier, what percentage of the grants are, just a given, are there any that are every year grant, that if they didn't have the grant, they would cease to exist, no other funding? What percentage of the total grants are continuing just for them, so they know they're going to get every year, and that it's taken the place of a budget?
Let's go there.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do have competitive application processes in most cases. The one area is Crime Victim Services, where we have developed a formula that we have been working off of over the last 5 years. But otherwise, we do have competitive processes.
Representative Cornish.
Well, that didn't answer it. What percentage of the total grants that are listed on these pages are continuing grants that they get every year that has taken place with their budget? How many of the grants are like that out of the whole mess?
Ms. Bovea?
Not mess. I mean, it's a good program, but...
Ms. Bovea.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would... the area of grants that have been ongoing for a significant period of time are the crime victim grants.
Okay. I'm not saying that that's bad.
Mr.
Chair, I just wanted to know just for how the grants work. I mean, if they've...
My idea of a grant was something that would be extra money or for a specific purpose. I'm just kind of trying to figure through my mind how many people just survive on grants, and that's all they get. So, thank you.
Representative Bergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have kind of two questions. The task force, which, you know, I'm really interested in the task force aspect of this. A lot of these cities, local municipalities and counties also put in, you know, they assign an officer to these task force. Have you had any discussions with these local municipalities and counties about, because of their cutbacks in their own budgets, if they're going to continue participating in some of these task force? And then I do have another question.
Ms. Lovier.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have had conversations, and to date, at least the gang and drug task forces are maintaining their level of support.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other question I have is, on each of these task force, how often are they audited for compliance and programming, you know, achievement goals?
Well, there.
Mr. Chair, Representative, each year they submit applications with their goals as well as any performance measures we ask them to improve. They are reviewed administratively each year, and we just completed a full round of those visits this year.
That's it. Mr. Chair.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to that point, so we have 11 FTEs who are administering $47 million worth of funding here. Are they the ones that review the applications for the grant process here?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we generally have outside review processes, independent review processes of various grant activities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson. No follow-up. Representative Coles, do you have quickly about a couple minutes left?
Real quickly, and Ms. Bavera, this is one of the questions that I'd ask. Maybe you can follow up with me, but is there a way that I, as a legislator or a citizen of the state of Minnesota, can understand? I think I'll pick on my own community. I think I saw a grant here for the Carver Scott Co-op. Is there a way that I, as a legislator or a citizen of Minnesota, can understand what the money being received from OJP is being used for by the grantee? And also, I think to Representative Cornish's point, how much of the organization's budget does that grant represent?
Ms. Bovair.
Mr. Chair, Representative, on your first question, we do not have, we post all our grants on our website. And we post all our applications on our website. Any kind of competitive applications are open to the public and on the website as well. I'm sorry, I don't remember the second part of your question.
Representative Cole.
Well, I'm not sure that the first part of my question was really answered. I understand that the applications are out there, but what's the Carver Scott Co-op doing with the money it gets from you, and how do I know that as a legislator or as a citizen of the state of Minnesota? That's the first question.
So there.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do have online progress reports. I can produce progress reports for all of our grants if you ask me for those. And people often do ask us for progress reports on how things are going. We are also in the process of developing an upgraded version of our grants management system that may be provide us an opportunity to provide more public information on activities.
I'll be done for now, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Levitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just a quick follow-up on Representative Coles. As I understand, most of those online follow-ups and reports that they have to file, they have to document numbers, et cetera, that are actually using the program, don't they? I have some familiarity. I've seen with some of those forms.
Ms. Bovier.
Mr. Chair, Representative, our progress reports and activity reports are really quite extensive.
Would you, does the committee want to see some of these? Would that be helpful?
Mr. Chair, maybe a sampling. I don't think we need to see all 600 of them, but maybe...
If you want to read back some of
these. Maybe one from each area.
Yeah, it might be helpful. Okay. Members, and Commissioner, could you have all of your people back here again next Thursday, even though some of them have completed their presentations, in case there's any grants, questions about grants, or especially the questions that we've asked you about the reality of a 5% cut or a 10% cut to your budget, what that might mean. So that would be next Thursday.
Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to be here.
Okay. And I just wanted to announce to members that the Thursday afternoon joint sex offender hearing Commissioner with Health, Human Services may be late, given that we have session, but we'll keep you posted on that. Is there any other business before the committee? If not, this meeting's adjourned. Thank you, Commissioner.